The Supreme Court's 1954 decision in Brown versus Board of Education, which declared the racial segregation of American schools unconstitutional, was a landmark moment in our nation's history. But today, the progress that Brown initiated seems increasingly tenuous. Since the high point of integration in 1988, American public schools have regressed back to segregation levels before busing began. Despite the unprecedented racial diversity of the overall population of the United States, more than half of school kids now attend hyper-segregated schools where over three-quarters of enrolled students are either white or minority. But as economist Rucker Johnson contends, these bleak statistics overshadow the larger story about how the school integration efforts in the 1970s and 80s worked stunningly well. He's the author of the new book, Children of the Dream, Why School Integration Works. And we welcome Rucker Johnson to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you this morning, and looking forward to discussing the ideas in the book.
Well, thank you very much. You are an associate professor in the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. What brought you to the subject of not only school integration, but the successes of it?
Yeah, so I'm an economist, and I was frustrated, actually, that the high degree of policy amnesia around the efficacy of some of the boldest education policies we've ever tried as a nation. And when you think about school integration, school funding reforms, the rollout of Head Start and expansion of pre-K investments, they're really the centerpiece of equal educational opportunity. And yet, school integration, among the most ambitious and controversial school reforms, there was just its long-run impacts remain widely misunderstood. And so I was really motivated to try to bring together new longitudinal data that could go back in time and use data as a time machine to follow kids, follow from birth to adulthood across several generations to be able to produce new credible evidence about the causal impacts of not just school integration, but the way it had synergies with other important reforms that affected school spending as well as early pre-K opportunities for disadvantaged children growing up in low-income and minority neighborhoods in particular, but not just those communities, but really using nationally representative for all children.
So let us start with what you are fighting against in this book, which is the narrative that came out beginning with, of course, Brown versus Board of Education on the effects of desegregation and what happened and what many people see as a failure of school desegregation.
Yeah, we hear that desegregation failed, that it was a social engineering without any real benefit. And as a result of that narrative, we've really turned away from integration as a goal and school desegregation as a strategy. But it turns out desegregation had big and lasting impacts, and not just on educational outcomes, but on earnings, on health, reducing the likelihood of incarceration, and not just for the children who attended desegregated schools, but we are able to document impacts for their children as well. And so it's important to understand the challenges that integration brought and the resistance that accompanied it, but it's equally important to understand what about it works and why. And it's my contention that it's the policy amnesia about these long-run effects of these policies and instead of myopic focus on short-run test score outcomes that's resulting in one giant pattern of failed school reforms.
You write in the book that the effect of attending integrated schools for all K through 12 years was large enough to eliminate the black-white educational attainment gap. What is that, and how did it indeed eliminate that?
Yeah, well, the period, one of the things that people, one of the biggest misconceptions of school integration is that it was tried for a very long time. You know, we're approaching the 65th anniversary of Brown, and yet, in reality, there's the significant efforts to integrate our schools only occurred for about a 15-year window. And so we gave up far too soon. But what it is that we reached peak integration levels in 1988. And in every year since, we've regressed back to the levels of segregation that prevailed before busing even began. And so part of establishing how I was able to close the gap is to go into the period in which the period when there was the greatest racial convergence of achievement gaps, educational attainment, earnings, health status, overlaps with these cohorts that were exposed to significant integration. And so what we really are able to show is that it worked before the recommended interventions could realize their potential at scale. And so it largely remains an unfinished agenda today, because our schools today are, as our classrooms, if you go inside them, they're as segregated as ever, despite the fact that the population of our school children have never been more diverse.
So when it comes to what we've learned from this, why then is it still, do we look at what we currently have as not enough? I mean, even in the book, you talk about the reforms that are needed. So where are we now? Where do we take that success? Because we can grow from it.
Yeah, so the idea that these results have no relevance for today is completely wrong-sided. The idea of these are antiquated, no contemporary relevance beyond, you know, the type of desk drawer history to be disposed of, or even the simplistic view that integration was just about shuffling school children across schools, is really missing really key components. So when we even think about the relevance for today, part of it is that we contend that the surges of racial prejudice, racial intolerance, the polarization of political attitudes, the unprecedented economic inequality, none of those things that we've begun to see take hold and be cemented are coincidence, but directly related to and exacerbated by the inequality of resources across our public schools and its lack of diversity. So what we've seen is that the achievement gap by income has increased by about two-thirds over the last three decades. It's currently about the same magnitude as the black-white achievement gap was before the Brown decision. We're talking about more than 1.5 grade levels that low-income children are on average behind the children from more affluent backgrounds, and yet we saw the black-white achievement gap decline by 40% in this era of integration. And so the question really is about how the trio of school funding reforms that enable school resource equalization, and remember, our most important resource that schools enable kids to access is high-quality teachers. And so the reason money makes a big difference is because 80% of a school budget is associated with some aspect of teachers, that it's how many teachers can you hire? Well, that determines class size. What are the quality of teachers you can offer? That is affected by teacher salaries. And what happens with overcrowded schools and underfunded schools is they tend to have a disproportionate share of teachers that are inexperienced and having lower credentials in the area in which they're teaching. And they're not able to kind of maintain the quality of retaining those high-quality teachers across the years. And what happens in its wake is significant opportunity gaps. So whenever we see achievement gaps, it's so important to trace them back to the opportunity gaps. And just as a prime example of this, that relates to the policies that have to be connected to integration efforts, is pre-K investments. So a half of the achievement gap that we observe among third graders, half of that achievement gap was already apparent at kindergarten entry, which really just highlights the footprint of early pre-K development and the opportunities that closing those gaps early, how imperative that is, because the gaps in school readiness by socioeconomic status are significant and require us to think about the important synergies between the pre-K investments in our expansion of public pre-K programs and the K-12 school reform and spending efforts, in all within integrated environments, really we find is the key to not just equal opportunity, but for all kids to be able to be successful and realize their potential.
Let me just touch on pre-K for a moment. You write in the book that currently less than half of all 3- and 4-year-olds attend quality pre-K programs. Obviously, it begins there, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, a big part of that is simply because, you know, the new research on neuroscience is highlighting just the key and astonishing speed at which our brains develop in the first three years of life. It's been shown that in those years, about 1 million new neural connections are formed each second. And what's most concerning is the way in which nurturing interpersonal interactions and play-based enrichment is so critical, but many children don't have those environments. And so it's these preschool years that can really release a cascade of neurotransmitter development and synapse growth in the developing young brain. But when there is some neglect and quality pre-K access is not available for many children, that type of healthy development and that promotes future learning. Because really these pre-K investments are not just an investment in knowledge for these young children, but it's an investment in the cognitive ability to acquire future knowledge. And that enables them to facilitate better learning in their K-12 system in terms of promoting the school readiness.
You make the point that it took 30 years to reach peak levels of integration in the late 80s, but we have regressed every year since then. Give us a sense of what caused that and then what we can do about it to bring us back to where you think we should be.
Right. Well, so let's think about a few components of this. Historically, the heavy reliance on local property taxes to fund public schools, coupled with housing policies and zoning ordinance codes that incentivize segregation, have really hindered both growth and opportunity. And those are things that the school funding reforms have played a central role in attempting to narrow, but they're uneven across both time and place in terms of what states have more progressive funding formulas that equalize spending efforts. And the way you want to think about this is that integration achieved to further and accomplish the goal by redistributing school children, while school funding reforms by redistributing resources, and the expansion of pre-K investments by redistributing the timing of school investments back to the earliest years of cognitive development. And what we show is that each of these policies make a significant difference on their own. But where the magic happens is the synergies that together they enhance one another. And it's the synergies between them that we find that when there are significant increases in K-12 spending, that it doesn't translate into significant improvements in educational attainment when it's not preceded by access to high-quality pre-K investments. And similarly, when kids have access to high-quality pre-K programs, but they subsequently attend K-12 schools that are underfunded and poorly resourced, we see that the gains that the pre-K investments enabled for those children to fade out. That is, we don't see lasting impacts if the quality investments are not sustained. And you made mention that I had discussed around how the long period of time before integration really took hold, but a big part of the delay was that the first decade after Brown, there was no significant integration. And so it wasn't until there was teeth put in enforcement and there were significant efforts to implement bold school desegregation plans that would integrate teacher facilities. Remember that before integration, much of the district-level spending was allocated to majority white schools, so there were significant differences in class sizes and school spending levels. Well, integration really helped level that, and when we were doing significant efforts along those lines. And now there's a few dimensions that really have developed differently. So there's a significant amount of middle-class flight, which has left a lot of concentrated poverty schools in which they're not just poorly resourced, but some of our highest quality teachers are selecting out of those schools because of their insufficient supports. There's curriculum reforms that are needed. And even I would just say that when the school choice movement emphasizes school choice, it's very important that we understand that parental wealth really conditions the ability to exercise that choice that the nature of the choice facing many lower-income families, and particularly disproportionately parents of color, is not high-quality school options in their local communities. And so it's the uneven access to opportunity that is being conditioned by wealth that is significantly hampering all children's ability to access learning opportunities that are truly equal.
The name of the book is Children of the Dream, Why School Integration Works. It is published by Basic Books. Rucker Johnson, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Children of the Dream, Why School Integration Works. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.